That's coming in all the time.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for your patience. We're tolling implementation committee meeting of September 30th, 2008 has now begun. And I'd like to thank the city of Kirkland for hosting us, and Councilmember Mary Alice Burley, thank you very much. I know you've had Mr. Olson and I over here one evening to address the council on this issue, and your council and city were kind enough to host us at your beautiful Performing Arts Center for one of our public sessions as well, so we appreciate that immensely. Representative Jarrett was with us for a few moments. I suspect he'll drop back in, but by way of introduction, my name is Bob Drewell, and I'm joined by
Paula Hammond, Secretary of Transportation.
Dick Ford, the Transportation Commission.
So, again, thanks for being here this morning. We have one action item, Mr. David Hopkins from Washington State Department of Transportation. This will deal with the meetings from our, the minutes from our last meeting.
Right. Those are included in your packet and available in case you have any questions. But otherwise,
I'll move approval.
Okay. Second.
Any discussion? Apparently not. It's been moved and seconded that the meetings, minutes, of our June 17th meeting stand approved. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Was that
aye?
September 11th?
I'm sorry, September 11th at Lake Forest Park.
Okay. Time flies.
Well, now assuring that I am reading off the right agenda, I will... go forward. We have a number of important issues. We now have been joined again by Representative Jarrett. Thank you, sir, for joining us this morning. That we've got particularly a certain amount of time set aside for four particular agenda items, discussion items at this time. And they will include an update of a potential I-90 hotline scenario, a review of the federal process and programs for tolling interstate highways such as I-90, future community outreach opportunities, and an introduction to our approach for investigating the impacts of tolls for on low-income users. So, David, David, if you could begin, and my agenda has them in the following order, so let's make sure we're synced up. We'll begin with an I-90 hot lane scenario, discussion, federal authorization, the low-income issue, and then finally a proposed public outreach where you'll be replaced by Linda, I think, on that particular item, and then you'll be wrapping up on the peer review. So if that syncs up with you, sir, we are ready to launch.
Thank you very much, Mr. Drewell. David Hopkins, staff to the committee at the Washington State Department of Transportation. The first item today is a discussion of proposed hot lane concept for I-90. If you recall, at your meeting on September 11th, you adopted a set of additional scenarios for the committee staff to work on and generate information on. And at that meeting, I mentioned that there had been interest expressed in a hot lane scenario and asked that we be given a little more time to come back to you at this meeting with a description of how that scenario might work. And so I've got a very brief overview of that potential scenario. It would be linked with a scenario that tolled the existing 520 bridge starting in 2010, and then that would be linked to an I-90 hot lane concept that would start tolling in 2016. The assumption is that there'd be two hot lanes in each direction on the roadway between I-5 and I-405, and that east of I-405, the existing HOV lane would be converted to a hot lane so that people could buy into the hot lane all the way from Issaquah to Seattle. But so that's sort of the basic general physical description of the hot lane scenario. I want to still leave you with a couple of caveats with respect to the work that we still remain to do on this scenario. The first is we've got to review the access issues and the geometrics associated with putting in such a hot lane system on I-90. If you'll recall, during the discussions with Sound Transit over moving the HOV lanes to the outside, that's known as the R8A project, that horrible title for it, we had to look at how site distances were affected by that, how the bike lane was affected. So we're going to need to do the same type of analysis with respect to this scenario to see if it meets those standards and if what kind of deviations, if any, would be needed. We'll also need to do an examination of the entrance and exit points and ramps and see how the hot lane would work near the junction of I-5 and the junction of I-405, where those movements could get fairly complex. And we also need to do a different type of modeling for this corridor. The regional travel demand model will be the first step we'll use that we're using for all the other scenarios. But we really need to do a more detailed simulation model for this particular stretch because hot lane behavior is different than general toll behavior when you're tolling an entire bridge. And then finally, we're going to need to get some cost estimates for the equipment required for that system and the proposed lane expansion out to Issaquah and what the O&M cost would be so that we can add that in. As a result of that work, we're not going to have the detailed information available for your meeting on November 10th. And I think what we'd like to propose to do is at those open houses, we would indicate that this is a scenario that we're continuing to study. We'd have that information available for you then at your meetings in December and would be available for the final report. So if in the meantime, as we're doing this analysis, we come up with any fatal flaws, obviously we'll get back to you with that right away. So that's our proposed approach, if you have any questions.
Questions for David?
All right, go ahead.
Only in general on the other tolling scenarios, I'm assuming you mentioned the price to implement the tolling on a hot lane. I'm assuming we're also calculating that on I-90 and 520 when we have those tolling scenarios?
Right. All the revenue models assume that there's some funds available for the installation of the equipment and then the operation and maintenance.
Okay. It just needs to be done for the hot lane set of equipment.
Right, exactly.
Okay. I've got a couple of questions. Is your modeling going to look at whether it's a two-person or a three-person requirement to use the HO, the hot lane without payment? Are you going to compare those? Because I always worry that we're selling something we haven't got. In other words, if the HOV lane is already pretty much full in the peaks, and then we say, well, you can still buy your way in. Well, the system doesn't allow that. And so it seems to me that you have to tell us on a threshold basis if is this going to, maybe with two lanes in each direction between 405 and I-5, there'll be plenty of capacity so you can stay at two. But I really want to make sure that that's looked at pretty carefully because I don't like to tell people that they can buy their way in and then they find out that they can't, even at $9 or some other outrageous price.
So that's one of the sensitivity tests we could conduct early in the analysis to see if there is capacity available under either of those under those two occupancy scenarios.
Okay. Well, one of the things we know already in a good portion of our HOV system is that the lanes are pretty full.
That's right.
During large portions of the day. And so that's part of our operational policies and how we are trying to move into the hot lane concept using pricing for probably 2+ and single occupants, but as a way to make sure those lanes stay reliable for movement for transit, vanpools, carpools, and people who are willing to pay their way in. So definitely that has to be a part of the analysis.
Well, in particular, if transit is stuck in an overflow HOV lane, which we now call a hot lane, but that's what it is, we have two sets of problems here. First of all, we have deteriorating service to the public, so it's harder to get people out of their cars onto the transit system. And the second thing is the cost of transit goes up, their operating cost, because basically their costs are measured by the hour. And if it takes longer to make the trip, they're getting fewer trips out of those buses each day. And so we really need to look at that carefully. And I know it's politically not palatable to go to three and all of the problems that go with that, but I'd rather keep the buy-ins out if it's going to deteriorate traffic in those lanes.
Well, that's one of the things. As you know, the hot lanes are dynamically priced, and there are times when the usage is high enough from HOVs that we've gone to HOV only on the 167 hot lanes. So that's one of the challenges of modeling, is to look at those assumptions and see when we anticipate that would happen and contrast that against another set of assumptions with respect to hot lanes.
But it has to be more detailed than that, David, because frankly what we're trying to buy is in the peaks. I mean, that's really where we have to know what the result's going to be, because I'm not too worried about the hot lanes at 1 a.m. in the morning. They'll probably be flowing pretty easily.
The whole concept behind the dynamic pricing is to make sure the lanes are moving. Traffic in the lanes are moving. And so that's some of the sensitivity that has to be tested. And you're right. You've got to make sure that you can keep the lanes moving and figure out how you're going to price it in a way to do that.
I think clearly the intricacies and the complexities of this modeling exercise, it gives good reason that it won't be ready by November. But I think the conversation here between two folks who have very, very good control of the subject matter, I think that take the time that you need staff-wise to get this one done right and in a fashion that we have a deliverable to the public and to the legislature and to the governor as well. But any further questions for David on this particular subject?
Well, I want to reinforce the point you just made, Bob. I'd rather say to the governor and the legislature in January, we don't have the answer on this yet, we're still looking at it, than to make the mistake of trying to rush something through and put it before them and then have it hung around our neck when it's proved that we didn't do enough homework.
I think, okay. Now let's just clarify that, you won't be ready by November 10th. But when do you think you'll have the information? Because I think it's doable.
Hopefully.
While we deliberate on, I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't overpromising.
I don't want to overpromise either. We'd hope to have that information available for you when you meet in December and begin the consideration of writing of your draft report. So.
Yeah, I think that it's doable from what I've heard staff say this morning and in a separate conversation. But I agree with you, but I don't want us to go to January and say we still don't have some answers. So I want us to keep the pressure on to make sure we have the analysis done.
Okay.
I'm watching Patty Rubstello here, who is our next presenter, who knows a little bit about this subject.
And she's a great poker face.
Absolutely. But, David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Patty, if you could join us on the federal authority to toll I-90, I don't think there was a public session that we had where there wasn't an inquiry of this nature, and frankly, of the number of city councils and county councils I've had a chance to chat with about this subject, the same question comes up, so I'm hoping that you can clear up this issue for us.
Well, I will try. Thank you.
So
one thing that's in your packet is a handout that actually Federal Highway Administration put together for us that highlights six different programs that they have available through the Safety Lieu legislation that authorizes tolling. Of those six programs, they range everything from a hot lane type toll facility to tolling an existing highway system. And we have had preliminary discussions with Federal Highways on the opportunities with I-90 to toll, and they think that it's possible, it's feasible, but they need more information from us. And so what we've done as part of their process is submitted a formal expression of interest where we lay out different scenarios for I-90, a hot lane concept to tolling the existing lanes, and then ask them several questions about that. What things that we want to hear back from them. One being, what programs do we think these different toll scenarios would fall under? Can the revenue that's generated from I-90 be used for improvements on 520? And then also, how can the toll revenue be spent on other things such as transit operations? So those are the things that we've asked of them. We're hoping to get some new preliminary response from them here in the next week or so, but with a formal response by your November meeting, and we're happy to come back and talk about that then. In the packet, though, one thing I wanted to highlight is of the six programs, one of them is the value pricing program. 15 states are eligible for that, and Washington State is one of those programs. And then the last program, which is Section 129, allows the ability to toll existing free highways. So those are probably the two that they're going to be looking at specifically for I-90, but we'll wait to see what they have to say. Now, just because they provide us information on those programs, which ones they think are feasible, there's still a lot of homework left to be done. If the decision is made to go ahead and toll I-90, there's a series of documents that need to be generated to provide the federal government assurance that we're continuing to take care of that facility, maintain it, operate it as it is today.
Patty, on the value pricing pilot program, the parenthetical statement has the word enrolled in it, and you use the word eligible. Are we all? Do we already stand in? Do we have an agreement that that the word enrolled applies, or that just implies eligibility?
So we are enrolled in that program. So we're one of the 15 states. And so only those 15 states are eligible to fall within that program and eligible for the funding that also each year they appropriate certain dollars to that program.
Okay. Thank you.
Is there a distinction in that program for the type of improvements or whether improvements on the facility are necessary?
That's one of the things we're hoping to hear from them on the specifics. It does give you the ability to do everything from a hot lane type improvement to, I think one of the key things about value pricing is it's about congestion management. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the primary focus for that program.
So we don't yet know what kind of restrictions come with that or commitments come with that?
Right, and that's one of the questions we're asking of them is what do these programs entail and what are the strings essentially attached to them that we need to understand? And that some of that comes with how to spend the revenue. Some of the last few pages of that handout tries to explain some of those, but we're asking some more detailed questions.
I assume that one of the questions you're asking is, can the dollars, let's assume there's a grade separation with an overpass, and in order to make this work better, you got to replace the overhead bridge, have a longer span or whatever, perhaps acceleration and deceleration lanes on the roadway, all of those things. Presumably, those are included in the questions you're asking, so we would know. I know that some of our problems on I-90 are access and exit problems in terms of backup of traffic and so on. So I assume all of that's in there because that might be an important part of improving the flow. In other words, there are pinch points, so to speak, mm-hmm. and improve the flow.
Yeah, that's definitely an important piece for them is to ensure the functionality of the facility. And they commented that it, a lot depends on how you describe the project itself. So the things you're spending the money on for that project, does it benefit that facility? Okay. So even making improvements that may be a half mile away may actually, you can demonstrate there's benefits to that facility and therefore eligible for that toll revenue.
So, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that the department's been before our committee at PSRC, and I know that at least in one of those presentations they pointed out that they've got a number of places along I-90 where they really need to improve access and the exits out of it if we're going to get the kind of uninterrupted flow that we would like to see on the highway. So I assume that's all built into your questions. Yeah.
Patty, a couple of questions, if I might. The process itself, does Secretary Hammond make the request, or how does that work first? And then secondly, of the other 15 states, didn't, assuming Pennsylvania was one of the enrolled states?
I don't believe they were one of the enrolled states.
They had a little kerfuffle here, didn't they?
They did. They went through the same process. They went through an expression of interest where USDOT responded back, letting them know which program their particular project could fall within. They then since submitted their application for that program and was denied that application. And my understanding, and I do have a letter that describes the what USDOT said about their application that I can provide to everybody, but it really highlighted the differences, I think, than what we're looking at, which is for Pennsylvania, they were looking at a concession, so they were essentially turning over that facility to a private entity, and they had this lease term, and they weren't able to articulate to the government's expectations what that lease entailed, and ensuring back to that the facility would be operated and maintained the way that the federal government would want it to be taken care of. Okay.
Then as to the process itself, always trying to be helpful, does the onus fall on our secretary, or is that a legislative or gubernatorial request?
For the agreement process, mm-hmm. that falls with the secretary.
Okay.
And we would do that once we had legislative authority to toll.
Okay. That's
the legislature decides where, and then if we need clearances of regulatory agencies, we would then request.
But the statute that set up this committee did ask you to inquire.
Right. So we're making those inquiries.
What we're doing now
yeah.
is within the legislative
right.
directive to the secretary,
right.
but you can't get the formal approval until you know whether the
right.
legislature.
Yeah, and I'm just trying to take right. the mysteries out of life about what we're about here and how we need to make our recommendations so that they comport with all of the other official stuff.
Could you explain the financial mess the world is in, too, while
yep.
you're clearing up mysteries?
If we get adjourned here, I can.
Okay.
Buy high, sell low. Any other questions for Patty? Patty, thank you very much.
Thanks, Patty.
Janet Matkin, again, this is a subject matter that I think the third piece of testimony that was offered from at our first meeting at the PSRC offices had to do with the economics of tolling and the impact on low-income or a low-income approach. So, Janet, if you'd let us know what you've learned.
Yes. Well, we're continuing to research this issue. But I will let you know where we're at this point, what information we have. One thing that we've done is conducted a research of what's happening on a national level, what have other states experienced in terms of how tolls affect low-income populations. What we found is there's not a lot of information out there, and what there is primarily focused on hot lanes rather than tolling the full corridor. But what we did find were some of the issues that were particularly important in looking at low-income populations are the cost of the transponders, whether you need credit cards to set up your electronic accounts. Did find that low-income people are more likely to pay the toll if it results in time savings and reliability. Those are key issues for particularly low-income populations who rely on the fact that they need to be at work at a certain time, need to meet certain obligations, and need that reliability and that time savings. There was a recent UCLA study that looked at how tolls compare to sales tax and found that while both adversely affect low-income populations, the tolling was more equitable than the sales tax because tolling is basically a user fee. And some studies have shown that low-income populations are more likely to use transit and more likely to carpool. So anything that makes those things more desirable would be of benefit to low-income populations. Then we looked at some local data, and this is an area where we're continuing to try and pull information. We looked at census data that showed the median income in King County is, and 2005 is the most recent census data that has it down to the county level. So the median income in King County was $58,351. The national poverty threshold for a family of four was $19,971. So about 9.6% of King County households were below that poverty line. That's in comparison to about 13% for the entire nation. So basically, King County has fewer people who meet that national poverty line. That's also one of the problems that we encountered with the research that's been conducted to date is how do you define low-income populations? So when you're using census data, that has to do with, you know, they've set very specific line, but a lot of the research uses 1.5 or 2 times what the poverty line is to define low-income population. So it's kind of comparing apples and oranges, and that's part of the dilemma in terms of how you define what population we're talking about. 80% of the bus trips in King County are on routes serving low-income populations, and we're going to be doing some more research about the actual patterns of behavior for different population groups.
Before you go forward, I know that some of the there were some very articulate presentations by, not that they all weren't, but
right,
but by students. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if the data fields indicate that, or if that's an entry into it. But
one of the things that I'll be talking about
in the
minute is a transit survey that we did. So I'll give you a little bit of information on that. These are the kinds of things that are already in place in Washington State with our Good to Go program, because we did take into account in setting up the Good to Go program some of these issues. So customers can establish Good to Go accounts with cash. They don't have to have a credit or debit card. Other states, they do. So that's something that's already in place here. Also available in Washington State, people can use their EBT cards, also called Quest cards. These are the cards that are issued by the Department of Social and Health Services for services such as food stamps and other services. And so people can use that card that gets replenished every month with the amount of money that they are eligible for. And one of the options available is to use that to set up and replenish a Good to Go account. And we have signs in the Good to Go customer service centers saying that we accept EBT cards. It's not been widely publicized, however, I don't think, within the DSH system. So that's something that we can work on, trying to improve that communication between the Department of Social and Health Services and their clients. We do have the Good to Go customer service centers that are available for cash customers. We also have a mobile center that can go out in the community and set up for, you know, a few hours at special events or businesses or in high traffic areas where we can actually establish accounts on site. Another thing that we're investigating is partnering with a retail establishment outlets where people couldn't go and set up their accounts and replenish their Good to Go accounts, you know, either while they're shopping at a grocery store or a pharmacy or something like that. And this has been done in other states. We don't have it in place currently, but it's certainly something that we're exploring with the possibility of tolling 520. Wanted to just talk a little bit about what's already been done by this committee. Some of the things, you know, we did advertise the open houses in a number of different publications, and the project teams for both the SR 520 and the I-405 projects are out in the communities on a regular basis, and they've been distributing information about this committee's work at those various events. And so there's a list of those available on where they've been so far this spring and summer. Some of the next steps that are being taken, we talked about the transit survey. There was a survey conducted of transit users. We've just gotten the preliminary information from that particular survey, but there were a significant number of university students who had passes that were part of that transit survey. So we'll be looking at that. In conjunction with the transit survey, we're also doing a telephone survey asking similar questions of people who who use the bridge, who are drivers, not necessarily transit users, but drivers, and looking specifically at low-income populations to, and also having a control group of non-low-income users so that we can compare what the effects and benefits might be to different populations.
Could you, the university, that's an easy one to understand, but would it be beyond the pale to perhaps survey Bellevue Community College and the technical colleges that are in the region that are impacted
as
well?
Yeah, and actually that's one of the things that we're going to talk about, going and actually talking with those different groups.
I'll just turn around here.
No, that's okay. You're asking good questions. I'm glad I'm able to respond to them appropriately. This is a list of some of the community groups that we're proposing to contact as part of this committee's work, so that we could talk with different groups who work with low-income communities and determine what kinds of things should we be looking at, and what kind of feedback can we get that might help us in framing how the entire tolling system is set up. What can we go back?
Could you add to that list? There's a group called the Executive Alliance.
Absolutely.
And I know as a board member at YWCA, they will oftentimes ask that group to be included in surveys that they're doing as well.
Who are they?
It's a group of all of the nonprofits in the 4-county region, but for the purposes here, it would cover, and there's like, I think, 400 organizations that belong. And it could be very useful, and they'd have data sources or contact points that maybe would make your job significantly easier.
Absolutely. That's wonderful.
And Melanie Brown is executive director there.
Okay.
I have a question, Bob. Sure. It seems to me a threshold question here is when are you eligible for some special treatment because of your income? What is the income level that we would, we know that an EBT card is issued based on certain declarations of your condition and income and so on. Is that the right standard for this bridge? Because it would be relatively easy, even if we had to supplement it a little bit, to make the EBT card worth more on the bridge crossing or whatever. So that, it seems to me this is a slippery slope for the state. And we need to be cognizant of that when we report this issue back to the legislature. Are they going to have a different standard of poverty, if you will, for those who drive cars across the bridge versus those who don't have enough food to feed their family because of their income levels? And I don't know how to answer that policy question for the legislature, but if that is it really that group, or is it the working poor that we need to be, and I'll throw into the working poor students on the theory that they are working on their degrees wherever they are in college. But Emmerich told us a couple of weeks ago when we met with him that over 70% of the people who come to the University of Washington campus every day come either in a bus, in a carpool, on a bicycle, or walk. That only less than 30% actually drive a car. And they have to pay a pretty hefty parking fee if they drive a car to the campus. Just to pick on the students for a moment, for an old guy that didn't get his first car until he was a year out of college, I couldn't afford it until then. I have a certain level of prejudice on this issue. Why are people who can't afford to go to college driving cars? But anyway, that aside, it seems to me the threshold question is, what is the standard that we should use to determine that a person deserves help on tolls? And should it be something different than the standard that's used to help them buy food or pay rent or the other essentials that are part of their life? Now, I wouldn't want to take a person who's in the what I'll call the working poor class and make their life impossible because they can't get from where they are where they live, for example, to where they work. We want them to make whatever effort they can, but we need to think that one through carefully, because we're really starting to get into an area where we have a huge struggle in the policy arena.
Absolutely.
As to what is poor and so on.
You make a great point.
Because otherwise, why don't we discount the gas tax for them? You know, if that's what you're going to get into, instead of paying 37.5 cents or 38.5 cents, maybe they should pay 15 cents or whatever. I don't know.
I think what we're looking
slow
for
down there, buddy.
Yeah. What we're looking for is what kinds of policies are fair and equitable and across the state agencies.
Well,
makes sense.
What if they drive up in a new Mercedes-Benz but they can prove they're poor?
They're probably
right. Do you give them a discount?
We're all going to be poor here in another month. It seems like there's two issues. Whether there should be a subsidy by income, and whether or not there's good options and alternatives to driving alone. And it seems like the school of thought that a well-functioning transit system provides that benefit or mitigation for the tolls for folks who can't afford it is how at least I've been thinking about it. And so I hope we don't just jump to the conclusion that there should be some cut and break, but I think it's very interesting to know what's happening nationally and a little bit more about the populations and how they feel about it as we're doing our surveys. So I'm interested in hearing more about the feedback.
Right. And that's in addition to the two surveys that are happening for the environmental justice requirements. They're also planning to do some focus groups. Two will be in English, two will be in other languages.
That'll be interesting.
We're continuing to compile data that is available on commute patterns, users of the bridge, population trends, where people live and work. Looking at all of those factors that contribute to making some decisions in this area. UW researchers are conducting a specific study on national research and local issues related to low-income populations and tolling. This committee is also planning to do both a web and a telephone survey in November. That will gather information from respondents on their income levels so that we'll be able to do some analysis from our surveys on how low-income populations may compare to other populations. And as I mentioned, we're looking at doing the meetings with those groups to do some specific outreach that will help us in terms of getting as much information as possible to include in your final report.
I think it's good to note, Bob, that we have a gentleman who's been very persistent about setting tolls according to people's means. At first he wanted to do it by income, but I think we've convinced him that most people don't have to tell us how much they make or what they're worth. So he's shifted now to a proposal that you would do it according to the kind of car they drive and the good to go. I can see all these executives getting. I wish I hadn't sold my 1969 Karmann Ghia, because it would probably qualify me for a low cost crossing. But it is very difficult. The administrative cost of having differential systems is pretty high, and the cost of tolling already is pretty expensive. I mean, it's not nearly as efficient as a gas tax, where we pay maybe 1% to collect it. We're up around 12% to 15% to collect and handle and manage the tolling operation. So I hope we don't. That's another consideration. Are you going to make this so complicated that the cost of administering the tolling system becomes bigger than the amount of money you have to pay off bonds?
That's absolutely a consideration.
Paul, any questions? Good. Janet, thank you.
Welcome.
Thanks, Janet.
We'll get to public comment later on, dear. And I didn't mean to be rude, but we've never broken ranks before, so I don't want to get fired from the chair here.
That's right.
So, Linda, this is a good segue for you to come forward to say thanks for the work that you've done and certainly the way that you put together the hundreds, if not thousands, of comments and forwarded them along to us. And I know that practice will make that even better. So. What are we going to do now?
We're always continuously improving. It's our goal. Linda Mullen with Enviro Issues. We're helping to support the outreach for the committee. And I just want to look ahead to this next phase of what we're doing. Just and with a reminder first of kind of what's always happening on outreach with the project. The website is always active. Online comment form is live, and that will remain in place. You know, we just officially closed a comment period that was specific to the original round of scenarios so that we could actually give you those collated and organized responses. But we're always taking comments. Briefings with elected officials, mayors, and city councils will continue. Briefings to other business, civic, and other types of groups that are interested that we've been to or who potentially we may have missed and want to learn about the project. Of course, your regular meetings today and the next meeting on the 10th. Media inquiries pop up here and there all the time, so we'll continue to respond to those. And we have an active relationship with the WSDOT listserv programs where they're contacting hundreds of or thousands of people, probably more likely, through their various project and outgoing email systems. So that's what is always happening. Just as you sleep, those things are in the works. Nobody needs to worry about those. You can sleep, right? If you're sleeping, I never know for sure with you.
If I'm not, I get up and read this stuff.
And that helps, doesn't it? Yeah. Okay. Moving on. So we're going to commence our next official round of outreach November 10th when you have your committee meeting and when we bring the results of the scenarios to you. We will also be launching that day or shortly or very, very near that our statistically valid phone survey. Janet just talked about that a little bit, and a web survey. The web survey is just another way to reach new people, get them involved, and find a way to get comments from people we haven't already heard from. And we will be re-engaging those thousands of people who we have heard from, making sure that they're posted on what we've been doing in this second round. We'll have some public meetings. We're going to advertise those and the web survey and all the new information through both traditional and online media sources, working with employers, transportation partners, CTR groups, and asking everybody to push that information out as they can to their subscribers as well. And then lastly, we'll have a second round of public meetings. We're looking at the weeks of November 10th and 7th. 17th. Can't read. We'll probably have three this time because it's a difficult time of year. It's dark, it's rainy, it's right before the holidays. We're looking at Seattle, Bellevue, and Mercer Island again. We're still securing the locations and the specific dates, so I can't give you those right now, but those are in the works. And then we will have, an official comment period for organizing these remarks into our final report that will essentially be from the time you guys meet through the month of November so we can make sure we have them incorporated into the draft report, draft final.
Paula?
I want to make sure I understand the various surveys and contacts that we're making. Janet talked about surveys, phone calls. Are they different than this web survey where we're actually looking into the low income and trying to ferret out specific information there?
The 520, we're working closely together. Okay. I just want to start with that. The 520 project itself, the replacement project, is doing some survey work of low income bridge users to ensure that they understand how the project is going to impact them. They need to do that for their environmental analysis.
Right.
We are doing a survey that's not particularly targeted to low income, but we will be able to identify, because we will collect some demographic information, if there are low-income people who respond to ours. And the way that we're setting that one up is we'll have a certain number of 520 users, a certain number of I-90 users, and then the same number of non-bridge users.
Dick, were you right?
No, I think you've done an absolutely phenomenal job in trying to carry this message to the public. And I guess I would say that I don't know what more you can do except keep doing what you've done. And I do think the scientific survey is important, so we get that on the record as well. I guess one of the questions I have, since we're the report that you put together on all this stuff, it's a hefty piece of work. Have we maybe in a as follows? Have you sent at least to the committee members in the legislature an email with a reference to this data, where they could click on and say, by the way, if you have any spare time between campaigning or whatever, would you, you might want to read this, because it gives you some flavor of what we're hearing in these meetings. And some of them will immediately delete, but a few of them may click on and want to kind of plow through it and see what is being said. Now, I know they can go to our website and get it. I'm just suggesting that maybe in the case of at least the committee members, you give them a direct link to the summary.
We'll do that.
And
that's a great suggestion. But one other thing, and I'm probably overthinking this, but there are some other activities regarding 520 going on, and I think because of the work that you've all done, we've done a good job in reminding people we are not in the bridge construction business, we are not in the bridge mediation business, we're in the tolling implementation business. Now, having said that, I don't know the schedules of those other organizations, but I would trust that someone here does. I don't want us to get caught up in whatever vortex is caused by a mediation report. I think that would confuse what it is we're about. So if you could just get an environmental set of when other folks are due to be perhaps making the same type of assessments or public response mechanisms that you're all engaged in, that I think that would be helpful to us in making sure that we keep those points clearly understood.
I wish I could say that I personally did this, but I can't. But we, as a group of people working on 520 projects, have put together a chart of what's going on with the not just the 520 projects, but also the Alaskan Way Viaduct project, and we're identifying other non-transportation issues, which might be having some big announcements between now and the end of the year, so that we're not stepping on each other's toes, stealing each other's thunders, or, you know, maybe if we want to, we could go under the radar, but I don't think you guys want to do that. But we are trying to be strategic and look at what else is going on and how do we fit in that environment.
So two questions. If that could be stapled to the report that Mr. Ford just suggested, and is that, these are public processes, they're all public record. I compliment the transparency that we've been engaged in. Is that something useful to put up on our website?
We would want to make some changes to the particular document, but absolutely, I think it would be helpful for people to know the environment in which they are operating, and we would want to probably just confirm with, you know, for example, non-DOT agencies that it's okay, but yeah, we can do that.
Okay.
Could I take this a little different direction? I want to make sure that we have the conversation about the number and the locations of the next round of public meetings. I think the number 3 sounds fine based on we've been in quite a few different areas. We had 6 preliminary meetings, and we saw sort of where the attendance was, and I hope that that's shaping where we're setting the next meetings. But these are probably going to be of high interest since we've done another round of modeling, and I want to make sure that we're picking locations that people feel are equitable to their communities' interests, and that we have a big enough location and enough time set aside to hear about the different communities' interests as they may come out of their community to one of these other locations.
Thanks, Paula. We are looking to return to the Bellevue City Hall. That was where we had the highest participation in the first round.
Right.
We hoped to go to the University of Washington as something new on the Seattle side. Our scheduler wasn't able to get with their scheduler, but Mr. Drewell suggested that perhaps we can get beyond the schedulers to get a room that was available and adequate in terms of size.
Okay.
If not, the Naval Academy, which is where we were before, is available. We would have a lot of options there again, and that size is fine, and people were familiar with it from the previous one. Mercer Island, the community center, is where we're looking, or where our first choice was. However, that's booked through November, and so now we're awaiting to hear from the high school if their auditorium is available. I think that would be probably adequate size.
And we had high participation there.
And Seattle was not quite as high as Bellevue, but I think the numbers were somewhere in the 60 to 70 range. So we want to make sure that, of course, we're on transit routes and, you know, the givens of ADA accessible and all of those things. But
right.
Our original thought was to try the university because we would get a cross-section of students and staff and people who would be directly affected. So we'll see if we can go back and find another spot there.
And to the Secretary's point, if you're not going to have as many meetings as you had before, then the meetings you do have should be longer just by definition. So.
Okay, we were looking at about, I think the time frame was 3:30 to 6:30, but we can look at extending that. We want to have a formal presentation again like we did, you know, with you guys down the Q&A right at 5, so that
somewhere
if people,
middle.
Yeah, if we were, you know, we'd probably get some rotation of people coming through, and we might catch people on the tail end of their, if they come early, and beginning if they come in the middle.
It seems like people who took the time out of their schedules to come wanted to be heard verbally. And so let's make sure we don't shortchange that part of it. I want to make sure we do this second round as well as we did the first one.
You bet.
Okay. Anything else? Thanks, Linda.
You bet. Thanks.
Mr. Hopkins, we've been ably served, as I think most folks in the room know, by a peer review group that has, I think, provided us substantial guidance, and we were responsible to respond to those suggestions. And David, that's what you're up to chat with us about.
Yes, at your last meeting, you asked about the status of the peer review report, and between now and then, we received the final report from Dr. Yoram Shifton, and he has transmitted that report to the peer review panel members and to the staff at the Puget Sound Regional Council and WashDOT, and the staff members have made comments on it, and the peer review panel made comments on it, and just 2 days ago I received the final report from Dr. Shifton. So I don't have a lot to say about it today, except that I think when I spoke to you last time, we had mentioned a set of suggestions for refinements to the model that the peer review team had come up with, and I mentioned that we would be able to implement most of those, but we're concerned that one of them might take a longer time. I'm pleased to report that the modeling staff at PSRC really worked very diligently to incorporate that last model refinement. I believe it was the one that took auto operating cost into the model where it wasn't before. And so the three key assumptions that the peer review panel came up with have been incorporated into the new model. We've done some initial calibration of that model. It looks like it's tracking very well with actual traffic volumes that are being experienced on the bridges today. So we think we've got a better, more refined model than we were using for the first set of scenarios that responds to the peer review panel recommendations. And just to highlight for you, the peer review panel thought the PSRC model was reflected very good national experience and was at the top of the range of models being used nationally. These refinements make it even better. So I just wanted what we have for you today is the final report in your packet. We've also asked you to sign some thank you letters to the peer review panel members. As you know, Dr. Shifton was compensated for his work, but Chuck Purvis from the San Francisco MTC, Eric Sabina from the Denver Regional Council of Government, Richard Walker from Portland's MPO, and Teresa Slack from the Georgia State Road and Tollway Authority served without compensation and spent a number of hours looking at the model, so we thought we should send them a formal thank you.
And we are indeed grateful for their services. Questions for David?
Just quickly. I assume that this report from Dr. Shiftman is going to go up on our website, and with whatever comments the staff at PSRC might report in terms of the changes they've made and so forth. I assume you'd want both to be there. Maybe it's adequate, the report, but you might also have Charlie or whoever is appropriate comment and put that up along with it.
Why don't we ask the staff to do like a one-page summary memo in terms of the changes that have been made to the model in response to the peer review, and we can post both of those, Commissioner.
I can't, however, go without reminding people these scenarios are being used to provide both this committee and ultimately the legislature and the governor with some background on what might happen under different scenarios as they've been structured out. But they are not ultimately the basis on which the tolls will be set. And I know a lot of people, the newspapers particularly, report if a scenario says we're going to use $3.50 a trip, that becomes the front page on what the toll is going to be. Well, the toll is going to be set with about three or four elements to it. How many bonds do we sell that are going to be paid off? That's the big number. What are the operating costs of the toll collection system? And that's a significant number, not near as much as the bonds. And finally, a few minor things like maintaining the structure until the bonds are paid off, insurance that is required in case the bridge falls down, and a few things like that. And we will not know that. First of all, the legislature has to decide they want to replace the bridge and toll it at all, which we haven't yet had them act on. So that's a little hurdle here that we keep skipping over, like the legislature is not going to be in the picture somewhere. But I, assuming they do, they have to decide what they're going to authorize in the way of bond sales. And once you start seeing those numbers and get some far more detailed decision on what the traffic count's really going to be, we won't know what the toll is going to be. And I just hope that people understand that this is very important work that's being done with these scenarios, but they are not the basis on which the tolls will be set. It will be set by a series of decisions that the legislature makes about how they're going to finance this bridge. And that hasn't been done yet. And I'm making the assumption that they will have toll bonds and perhaps other kinds of bonds as well. That's part of the financing. A few other little details, like what are we going to pay in interest? Right now, interest is pretty good, but it might not be when this goes to the market. So there's a lot of moving parts to it.
Thank you very much for making that point. One of the peer review panel's recommendations in their midterm recommendations was that while the regional model is important and sufficient for this level of analysis, a more detailed corridor-specific analysis should be conducted as the project advances. And so before we get to the point of actually placing tolls on the bridge and developing the financial plan, that's a much more specific corridor model will need to be put in place for the 520 bridge.
Secretary Hammond, any questions for David?
No, I think that's great. Thank you.
Thank you,
David. This is a point we've come to public comment. And we had a question earlier on. Step up to the mic, please. And introduce yourself so we can find you if need be.
I'm Jerry Hodimacki. I'm a toll systems engineer with HNTB. Referring back to the low-income portion of the presentation, in Puerto Rico, they have a program in which they have, and I believe it's in excess of 25% of their patrons, do not have a credit card. And they have a barcoded card that they can take into grocery stores or drug stores, and that gets scanned. They give them cash that gets applied to their account. In South America, in particular in Santiago, Chile, and the new systems down there, their non-credit card people are much higher, and they're using a similar program. So those programs are in place. They're very successful, and there's a lot of experience with using them. And there's been a fair bit of work done within the last few years through IBTTA, the Toll Road Association, for what are being called non-banked participants. So that is a reference point for your consideration of the low income.
Jerry, thank you, and thanks for attending these meetings over the course of the summer. Any other public comment? Okay, we stand adjourned with our next meeting on November 10th at 3 o'clock with the location yet to be determined.